You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Power of Doubt, Part 3. For the last two episodes, I've been describing for you the philosophy of skepticism as it applies to the martial arts, science, and life in general. As I said then, skeptics place a great deal of emphasis on research and evidence. It's important to remember, though, that there is evidence, and there is evidence. It comes in a variety of levels of quality. Many people think of eyewitness accounts as being powerful evidence. Believe it or not, they are actually among the weakest forms of evidence. Human perception and memory are fallible to a fault. Humans are also prone to allow bias to color their stories. They've even been known to gasp, lie. Eyewitness testimony is a form of what is known as anecdotal evidence, which is notoriously weak, and yet is by far the form of evidence most commonly cited by people trying to make an argument. Many people would consider larger quantities of anecdotal evidence as carrying more weight than do smaller quantities. In other words, if hundreds of people claim they saw Bigfoot in the year 2015, that must mean more than if only one person claims to have. Right? Not really. As I mentioned, we are genetically predisposed to be convinced more readily by compelling stories than by evidence. This instinct makes us very prone to listen to and give unwarranted weight to anecdotal evidence. But the mere existence of our instincts does not make anecdotal evidence reliable. And as I said, larger quantities of it carry no more weight than do smaller quantities. There's even an old saying among scientists about this. It goes, "The plural of anecdote is not data." Let me draw a parallel for you from sport martial arts. If you compete in sport jiu-jitsu, you know what scoring an advantage is. When a jiu-jitsu player almost, but not quite, pulls off a scoring move or a submission, he or she is awarded by the referee with what is called an advantage. This is purely a judgment call, and it means nothing if the match ends in anything but a tie. Advantages exist only to break ties. So if your match ends in a tie, and you have scored 3 advantages, and your opponent has scored 2 advantages, you win the match, if only by the skin of your teeth. So that means that advantages are only cumulative against other advantages. Now, I'm not going to discuss today whether I think advantages are a good thing or a bad thing for sport jiu-jitsu. That's a topic for another day. My point is that this runs in parallel with anecdotal evidence in a peculiar way. If you score 30 advantages on me, and I score 2 real points on you, perhaps by taking you down, my 2 real points beat your 30 advantages. There is no amount of advantages that will beat 1 real point in jiu-jitsu competition. By the same token, there is no amount of anecdotal evidence that adds up to the quality of a single laboratory study under carefully controlled conditions. In a similar fashion, one carefully controlled DNA analysis of an alleged Bigfoot hair carries far more weight than thousands of people's stories about seeing Bigfoot. So when your classmate tells you that hundreds of people have seen ninjas levitate, or that he has heard that lots of people healed their own injuries with their chi power, it's probably okay for you to call bullshit, or at least to ask to see better evidence. So a good skeptic should seek evidence gained through carefully controlled observation, studies, and experiments. But even with these potentially powerful scientific tools, there's still room for our wacky human brain to cause trouble. Every single human is biased. What's worse is that we are all nearly always blind to the knowledge of what we are biased about. A good scientist knows that this is true, and that it includes even himself, and that human bias can corrupt the collection of data. As a result, he assumes that he will be biased and builds controls into his experiments to filter out the effects of bias. Bias and logical fallacies can also come into play when interpreting the data after the study or experiment is complete and all the data has been gathered. This is one of the many reasons why results are published in scientific journals, or should be, so that other highly trained experts in the same field can take a crack at interpreting the same data. This further strengthens the process, resulting in fewer biased interpretations. This process allows the competitiveness of humans to come into play as a force for reason. If you think you've seen some great fights in your time in the martial arts, you should check out some of the bloody nerd battles that happen in the letters and comments sections of scientific journals. Biased interpretation of data rarely survives this process for very long. The evidence from any single, carefully controlled study or experiment is good, but it becomes far better when its results are replicated many times by many other scientists. Does this hierarchy of evidence mean that anecdotal evidence is worthless? No, it's not worthless. It just shouldn't be considered anything more than a lead. When a detective is trying to solve a case and says he has a lead, this does not mean that he knows any evidence to be true. It just means that he has found a new direction in which to point his investigative eye. A large quantity of leads is not necessarily any better than one lead or no leads at all. Many leads don't pan out. As a matter of fact, most leads don't pan out. That doesn't make leads or anecdotal data worthless. It's better to say that they have little to no value until they've been investigated. But once anecdotal evidence has been investigated, the investigation will result in either real data, or more often, it will reveal that the anecdotal reports had been a false lead, a dead end in the investigation. So, we've discussed many different ways that developing critical thinking skills and a skeptical outlook can be helpful in all facets of your life. Most people who begin to understand and appreciate the value of skepticism and critical thinking skills go through a bit of an evolution. In the stage before they begin to grasp these concepts, they, like most humans, simply have beliefs, without ever bothering to investigate the evidence behind them. Once they begin to understand the importance of research, they enter the next tier of skepticism. This is the level of those who believe first, and then investigate. This is a big improvement, but the problem here is that their investigations will tend to be distorted and influenced by their beliefs. People in this tier tend to be very susceptible to confirmation bias, which is the tendency to emphasize evidence that confirms your belief and to ignore or de-emphasize evidence that does not. Learn to become concerned when you realize that you want a particular claim to be true, or that you want it to not be true. The highest level and most efficient form of skepticism is to have as a baseline no belief, and to then investigate in order to develop the best working model, as opposed to a belief. The simple fact of identifying as or claiming to be a skeptic does not make you immune to making any or all of normal human mistakes. A good skeptic is humbly aware of this and struggles every day to resist falling prey to them. He or she also pursues continuing education about these weaknesses. So what does skepticism have to do with the martial arts? My first significant awareness of the intersection of skepticism and the martial arts came from Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee was obviously a highly skilled martial artist. In addition, he had excellent critical thinking skills and applied what was essentially scientific skepticism to his research into various martial arts styles and exercise science. One of his most famous sayings was, "Research your own experience. Absorb what is useful. Reject what is useless. And add what is essentially your own." Last week, I regaled you with a description of my first 10 years in the martial arts. First, as a clumsy nerd who had no confidence in his physical ability or potential, and later, as a cocky young martial artist. Another aspect of my early clumsy and nerdy phase was that my inexperience and youth left me ridiculously credulous to truth claims. One truth claim made by my first karate instructor was that boxing is an unscientific form of sanctioned brawling, not to be admired or emulated. Because I accepted this truth claim as completely as I did, I didn't seek out knowledge of boxing on my own until much later, a mistake that I still regret. Moving on to my cocky young fighter stage, when I was that guy, I listened very carefully to the part of Bruce Lee's motto about rejecting what is useless, or at least what I deemed to be useless. But I didn't concern myself nearly enough with absorbing what was useful. At least at a subconscious level, I probably thought I already had most of what was useful, a common feature of cocky young fighters. My level of skill and history of success against quite a few different sparring partners led me to make snap judgments of just about any new technique or style of fighting that I saw. Had I been thinking more critically about my assumptions, I might have asked myself, by what criteria do I decide what is useful and what is not? Had I been a good skeptic at that point in my life, I would have realized that I needed to more thoroughly research each new technique or style of martial arts which I came across before judging them. Instead, my attitude was based on evidence gathered from what was actually a very small sample, that sample being the few hundred opponents with whom I had sparred up to that point. I was a big fish in a very small pond. I can remember in the late 1970s, sitting in a pizza joint, waiting for my food, and watching silent 8mm films that the restaurant played for the customers. One of the films was of Muay Thai fights. My arrogant reaction to this footage was one of eye-rolling and ridicule. Based on this minuscule amount of data, I judged Muay Thai and found it wanting. It looked to me like the stance and guard these fighters exhibited left them wide open to attack. I had obviously not, at that point, sparred or trained with a Muay Thai practitioner. My rash judgment of this excellent martial art was obviously a foolish mistake, a mistake which I'm glad that I later corrected. I can also remember reading about the Gracie family and their jiu-jitsu clear back in the 1980s in martial arts magazines. The claims they made at the time sounded similar to me to those I had heard made by advocates of many other systems of martial arts. I decided, foolishly, based simply on reading these articles, that the Gracies offered nothing that I needed. I was not yet a good skeptical martial artist. A skeptic is always ready to examine his or her assumptions and reevaluate them. This is what makes assumptions different from beliefs. For example, there's a common principle, or to put it more accurately, a heuristic, practiced in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It is expressed in a saying that goes, "Position before submission." This means that you spend the majority of your time when grappling on the ground, staying out of your opponent's control and getting into and maintaining a position of control over them, rather than thinking about trying to force submission at any one time. Once you do effectively gain a control position, it may then be time to think about forcing submission. Or more likely, it may be time to use your position to fatigue the opponent before then moving on to submission attempts. This is a powerful heuristic. It helps to organize your thoughts in the chaos of grappling. Its use frequently prevents beginning and intermediate jiu-jitsu players from making foolish mistakes by attacking too quickly and thus losing their position of control. This heuristic often leads to success, both in the gym and on the competition mat. But like all methods of quick and dirty thinking, it is not true 100% of the time. A notable exception to it can be the rear naked choke attack. The, quote, proper, unquote, position from which to execute this choke is to be on your opponent's back with your legs hooked around the outside of his legs. If, however, you have developed solid technique with the upper body part of this choke and get an opportunity to clamp your sternum on the opponent's upper spine at the proper time and keep it there, you can frequently finish the opponent without inserting your legs as hooks. There are many cases in which, had you waited to put your hooks in first, the opponent would have realized the danger and begun defending against the choke. Without putting in my hooks, I am violating the position before submission heuristic. But in this case, however, the heuristic does not serve me as well. I can frequently finish my opponent with ease, without much risk of losing my place on his back, thanks especially to techniques and variations popularized by the great Marcelo Garcia. This fact, which acts as an exception to the heuristic position before submission, does not totally refute the value of the heuristic. Position before submission still has tremendous power. It is simply the case that this heuristic, like all heuristics, is not always valid. Once, when I choked a partner without putting in my hooks in this fashion, he tapped rapidly and unambiguously to signal submission, and then looked at me as if I had grown two heads. He sniffed arrogantly and said, "You did that wrong. You didn't put your hooks in." I simply shrugged and left him to ponder the absurdity of this criticism. A skeptical attitude in the martial arts helps lead you to do the training you need to do rather than the training you want to do, and to use the strategy that you need to use rather than the strategy that you want to use with any given opponent. For these reasons and many others, developing your critical thinking skills and becoming scientifically skeptical are very worthwhile goals. There is profound power in learning to reduce the influence of the weaknesses of the human brain in everyday thought and action, and in the martial arts. If you want to learn more about skepticism and critical thinking skills, here are two excellent podcasts produced by people who do a much better job than me. One is called Skeptoid, and the other is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. If this thing called the Martial Brain Podcast ever amounts to anything, it will be 99% because of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. That's all that needs to be said about that. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, or listen to earlier episodes of the Martial Brain Podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.